Welcome, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast. Along with J.J. Cooper, I'm John Manuel, coming to you on a very exciting day at Baseball America. It's Prospect Handbook Shipping Day. I'm surprised you could even hear us over the din of Ronnie McCabe's tape gun wrapping up. That's it. Wrapping up all of your prospect handbooks for shipping to your home, office, bedroom, boudoir. I want to remind you, you can order the Baseball America Prospect Handbook, along with all of our books, the directory, the almanac, the fantasy guide. I don't think I ever mentioned the fantasy guide because this promo was written in 2011 before we had one, but they're all available at baseballamerica.com/store. That's baseballamerica.com/store. And again, the Prospect Handbook already shipping. If you haven't already ordered, what are you waiting for? You can also order by calling 800-845-2726. So we're here to talk Prospect Handbook, JJ, and we can go a little bit lighter to start, or we can go a little bit heavier to start. The lighter start would be ranking. You wrote a story about ranking our all-time cover boys. We could start light. That's kind of a fun subject. And then we can maybe get into the heavier stuff, which is really kind of the defining characteristic of the handbook these days, which is, and of the rankings, which is our BA grades. That might be a heavy discussion.
Let's go heavy.
We can start in on heavy, because the Baseball America grades, and I'd be interested to get feedback from our listeners after this podcast is over. You can send them in at podcast@baseballamerica.com. You also can just email me at johnmanuel@baseballamerica.com. I'd love to know people's feedback on the Baseball America grades, or grade slash risk. We just call them BA grades, but there is a risk factor applied to all these players, especially after you get your handbook this year, because we've gone a little bit more heavy on the extreme risk factor in this year's handbook. And but really, the handbook grades have redefined the handbook rankings in a lot of ways, JJ, because I had this question and answer in the chat today that we did at baseballamerica.com. It used to be the 21 to 30 a lot of times would be younger guys. Your top 10 would be your top 10. That would just be a ranking of really best overall ceiling and chance to reach that ceiling. Maybe you'd mix in a reliever who you thought was really going to help in the fourth, in the next season, into that top 10, but not too often. But now, and then you'd have like some more veteran guys, almost like 4A types who might still have a chance in that 11 to 20. And then the really younger guys and draft guys would be in the 21 to 30. Now it's pretty much just ceiling and risk of risk of reaching that ceiling in the 1 to 20 and 21 to 30 is relievers because they all have lower ceilings and they're all risky. And that, I think that's a logical extension, but it really does take a little bit of the guesswork out of it when you're trying to rank stuff. But generally, most of our 21 to 30s are pretty much full of future setup men of America.
I would say future setup men, and also that's where you do still see some of the lower ceiling far away guys. Like an outfielder who is far away.
And future fourth outfielders of America.
Right. And I think that's an improvement that we've done in the rankings the last couple of years.
I agree.
In that the reality of it is that relievers, if you are a minor league reliever, I hate to say this to you, if you are pitching relief innings in the minors, you do not have much value to teams as far as other teams until you at least are very close to the big leagues.
Yeah.
That's just the reality.
Or until you start a game or two,
right.
You know.
The reality of it is that when you talk about a guy who, if you're relieving in A-ball, you better have some of the best stuff in the minors, or otherwise you are just another guy until you prove it at higher levels up the system. Because, and I think that's something that our rankings reflect, is that the reality of it is that most of those guys who are going to be the future setup men of America are starting at those levels.
Yeah, and the exceptions are in organizations that have tandem starter systems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the Astros did this year.
But even those, you treat those all as starters because they're
right.
They're making 14 starts and not 28.
Right. It is. It's hard to see a pitcher as a prospect when his own major league parent organization is not giving him 75 to 100 innings in a minor league season, especially the low minors.
Well,
it's because to get to that many innings, you're gonna have to make some starts. Well, if you're getting that many innings, maybe if you're in, again, like a, where you're getting 3 innings every 3 or 4 days, but it's just so rare that most of your big league relievers are failed starters or often converted hitters. So.
And the other thing with that is that we see so many stories of really middle of the pack, middling starters who do make that move to the pen, and all of a sudden they're very interesting relievers.
Right.
Right. I know. I mean, both of us have written up many of those guys. Michael Marriott, who's in the Royals top 30, I wrote up this year, is to me a prime example of this. I watched that guy as a starter a couple of times when he was in A-ball, and there was nothing there. He really, what he was at the time was Noel Arguez's caddy. Noel Arguez started the game, and then he would pitch 4 or 5 innings on the back end of Arguez's start. He goes to the pen, and all of a sudden you see the fastball jump up a solid tick, you know, at least, and all of a sudden his breaking ball is a lot better, and you go, oh, this guy could pitch the, you know, 6th or 7th. That guy, when you are at a Class A game, you're going to see, I've asked this question to scouts multiple times, how do you separate out the relievers that you see in A-ball? Because you're going to see a guy who throws 92, 93 with some sort of breaking ball most every night.
And there is more velocity in the lower minors than there is in the upper minors.
No, absolutely.
You go to a AAA game, and you're going to see some relievers come out of the bullpen. I mean, who was the left hand? R.J. Swindle?
Oh, yeah.
For Durham, who was topping that at 83, 85, and throwing, you know, upper 50s slow curveballs. And, you know, I actually was talking to a scout about who worked out a player in the Dominican this offseason, and he thought I would remember the pitcher. He said, like, we had a workout, and we had to bring a pitcher in. And the guy they brought in used to close at Durham, threw a lot of sliders. You remember I said, Winston Abreu? He goes, yes, Winston Abreu.
I covered him in Macon.
I said, Winston Abreu is still pitching in winter ball. And, you know, Caribbean Series is going on right now. And I don't know if Winston Abreu is in it or not, but the guy still throws a slider. And he's very useful. That's a job he's going to have for a while probably, is getting paid to come in and throw that slider against guys you're working out. It was actually, I was talking to somebody about Jose Abreu. And so they brought in Winston Abreu to face Jose Abreu, the Cuban slugger, to see how does he do against a close to big league level slider. And he did pretty well. So but Winston Abreu had a long professional career, briefly got to the big leagues, but was basically a reliever in A ball, in low A. And that's just not a great profile. I always come back to this guy named Jackson Markert, who it took me forever to remember. And I was searching feverishly on my iPad. Jackson Markert led the minor leagues in saves in 2001 in Hagerstown. He was 22 years old. He had 39 saves. He had a 2.80 ERA. He didn't strike anybody out. He pitched 61 innings. I did a Giants chat that year. It's like, why isn't this guy in their top prospects? Like, well, minor league reliever. So this is not a new phenomenon. It's an old phenomenon.
Going back several years, but David Cortez, year, Odalis Perez, who ended up violating the rule, but he was a reliever in A-ball who ended up being a starter. And again, if you move back to the rotation, all bets are off. But Odalis Perez was a setup man for the Macon Braves, and David Cortez was the closer. And Cortez, I believe, you know, I may be coloring it in my mind now because it was 15 years ago, but I think he went into the All-Star break without having allowed a run yet.
Yeah, he had a monster minor league season. I remember that.
And
Shorter, thicker guy, right?
Shorter, thicker, but he had plus stuff and all. I mean, everything you would want to see as far as that. And he basically was an up-and-down guy. Because, again, if you are even a dominant reliever in A-ball, that doesn't really add up to a whole lot as far as your chances of being a big league success.
You know, Dallas is only 35 years old. I'm surprised there hasn't been an Odalis Perez comeback attempt this offseason. What have we got? Mark Mulder?
Yeah.
Isn't there some other really random comeback attempt that's out this offseason?
There was. I can't remember the
name. Tomooka. Yeah, Tomooka coming back as a knuckleballer. That's about right. As random as it gets. But yeah, Odalis Perez relieving in Macon in 1997 as a 19-year-old, but went back into starting in 1998, big leagues in 1999.
He couldn't fit in the rotation because it was Rob Bell, Bruce Chen, Jason Marquis, Jimmy Osteen, Jason Scheel, who did make the big leagues.
Yeah.
And late in the season, the best of them all, Luis Rivera.
Nice, that's right. Traded
Orioles, and then got hurt. And if you said, like, Jason Marquis and Bruce Chen have had lengthy, lengthy big league careers, they did not compare. I mean,
to Luis Rivera.
Luis Rivera. Chen was the pitcher of the year in that league, but Rivera came up in the season and was just absolutely filthy.
Yeah, he was supposed to be pretty dirty. I never saw him pitch, but I think he was number one or number two in Orioles prospect list, right ahead of or right behind Ed Rogers back in those days. So Orioles fans, you think you've had it bad in the recent years until the last two. Think back to the Ed Rogers, Luis Rivera days when all your eggs were in the Ed Rogers basket. Those were the bad days. But relievers, the reason we start off talking about relievers and these rankings is, you know, we use a 20-80 scale, really more like a 35 or 40-80 scale, basically, to be in this book.
We're right at 900.
Yeah, there are no 20s in this book, thank God, or 30s. There was almost a 35 this year, but we decided to get rid of the 35 grade altogether. And we might get rid of the 80 grade next year because it really all these guys are kind of scrunched in between. And we've given 180 in 3 years of the BA grades. And it wasn't to Mike Trout. Probably should have been.
We're not going to get rid of the 80, but we'll still keep it locked up in a special vault.
If Mike Trout, mutates into two Mike Trouts, then maybe, like, younger Mike Trout.
I'll say right now, I could imagine Byron Buxton having a season this year where somehow if he still had prospect eligibility at the end of the year.
Right.
I don't think it's likely, but if Byron Buxton goes out and effectively is better than he was last year in AA and AAA,
so he's
and
basically
shows
last
power,
year with more power, yeah.
If he does that, he's a 75 now. It would be hard to say if he basically was our minor league player of the year again and he's already shown power at that point, I could see 80.
You're probably right. We still have, but we have 75 and 80 for franchise players, number one starters, guys like Miguel Cabrera, Clayton Kershaw, David Price, Mike Trout. I don't think anyone's going to question those guys. Talk about a franchise player. The only one of those guys I just mentioned who's questionable is David Price.
But even
as a
then,
franchise player, but I still think he's a number one. I think he's a
right.
true
and
number one starter.
The only difference between him really and these other guys we're talking about, and Trout's weird to say this, but Trout had two Hall of Fame years already.
Right.
I mean, but the other guys on this just have a longer track record.
Right.
Like, David Price has had a year that puts him in the same conversation with Clayton Kershaw. Clayton Kershaw's had multiple years like that.
So if we think a prospect's going to turn into a player like that, he gets a 75 or an 80. 65 or a 70, number two starters, perennial all-stars in the mold of Adrian Beltre, John Lester, Yadier Molina. You know, Adrian Beltre in his best years is a 70. He's in the clutch of best players in baseball. In his lesser years, he's a 65, which means he's just one of the best third basemen in baseball. Same thing, John Lester to me is more of a 65 than a 70, but he's had like 60 regular seasons and he had a 70 World Series. He was the number one starter on a championship team this year. In the postseason, his regular season, he still hasn't been quite as good as he was 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And that 2012 season still sticks out a little bit for Lester, for me to call him a 70. But again, you're talking about what is the profile? Number one starter on a championship team? John Lester is pretty close to that profile.
He's close, but I'd
say he's more of like a classic number two. But, yeah. So.
And that's the thing we've talked about this a thousand times before, but there aren't 30 number one starters.
Right.
There may be 10.
There are 30 opening day starters. There are not 30 number ones.
And with that, it's not coming just from us. Scouts are very, we always get the question, could this guy be a number one? And I really think our default answer on that is generally
no.
We don't, it's not that it's not possible, but what you're asking, part of being a number one is that exceptional command.
Right.
And the best way to put it is you don't ever see that in the minor leagues, and it's so hard to project that. When you say, hey, when you say we're going to project that this guy is going to have plus command, well,
right.
How do you project that? Because that's something that when you talk to scouts, they're like, that's almost impossible to project.
And, that to me also kind of dovetails into this year's draft where we talk about this, and you and I have talked about this a lot with what's the difference between Jeff Hoffman of East Carolina and Carlos Rodon. Carlos Rodon does have now, he has shown, especially in that start against Cuba last year, but in the second half of each of his college seasons, he's shown you present major league average control.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you'd say command. He might have shown you that. I thought he did. I'm not a scout. Talked to enough scouts. I haven't asked them for his grade of his fastball command from that Cuba start, but he put it where he wanted it. He was in total command. The quote that I had, I don't even know if I use it or not, was that any hitter in the world would have had a hard time with him that night.
You did use it.
Did I use that in the All-America team? I mean, that says it all. He had present major league command that night.
But that's the key thing that night.
Yeah, that night. Right, that's right. Doing it consistently every night, 33 times a year, That's a very different deal.
That's the thing. You can see at a minor league ballpark, the perfect night, you can see a top pitching prospect show you everything.
Yeah.
He can show you plus command on a night, but it's very rare that you ever see a pitching prospect in the minors who does that multiple starts in a row. And again,
they go to the major leagues.
Right. I mean, you should, because the reality of it is, again, I'll back this up a little bit. I know this is the Baseball America podcast. Our listeners, I'll do a very short version of it for someone, but we do want to make sure that people do understand. Talk about the difference between control and command. Control is you're throwing strikes. Mm-hmm. Command is you're hitting the spot.
And put it this way. Here's a great illustration of it. Cliff Lee is almost, if you're talking a major league starter in the last 10 years, not named Maddox, even in the last 10 years, including Maddox, mm-hmm. if you're of the belief, like a lot of scouts are, you're talking about there's one guy who's an 80 command, you might have been Cliff Lee as that one guy. I mean, I don't know how he would, I haven't asked that question, but right. To me, like Roy Halladay, Cliff Lee, Maddox would have been in that discussion.
Maddox is the 80. I mean, there's like...
But not in his late career. It was...
Yeah, I'm saying, but in his prime...
Peak, in his prime,
that could be the 90.
Exactly. Absolutely. He's the 0.3%. But Cliff Lee was 4.2 walks per nine in the minor leagues.
That's what I'm...
That's
point,
exactly what JJ's talking about.
My point is that you cannot, in any way, shape, or form, if you tell me that you can see in a 20-year-old, oh yeah, that guy's going to have plus command... I want to talk to you and have explained some way how you understand that, or even if you can't explain it, I would love to hear, you know, hey, okay, well, tell me, let's just look at it now. Tell me three guys now, and let's look at it five years from now. Because, again, it's such a, just doing this thing when we go to the light version of this, talking about covers and all. Josh Beckett was at the time, if you said, draw me up a hard-throwing right-handed pitching prospect.
Absolutely.
Hard to do better than that.
Absolutely. That's why his contract was a record for a high school pitching prospect for so long.
That being said, there has been that last step. He's been very good. But for the majority of his career, it's hard to say that he's been there where you want to as a true number one. I'll give another guy. Homer Bailey, who... you know, was right at the top of our list for multiple years there.
Daddy, Homer. Sorry. I always think that.
And you're seeing flashes of it now. He's had two no-hitters.
Right.
On his best night, he's every bit of a number one.
He's very similar to me, to Josh Beckett. And you don't think about him that way, but his career has been similar.
And with Bailey, you are seeing kind of steady, better, 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 better. That being said, we're now, what, 5 years into his big league career?
He's a free agent then in 2014.
He's 5 years into his big league career, and you're still saying, well, it may get there. That's right. Where, again, I come back to, that's the part, it's really hard to pitcher. It's a lot easier with a hitter to throw a 70, you know, to say that this guy, to throw a 75 BA grade than it is a pitcher, because it's just, there's so much more that has to happen at the big league level.
Right. I mean, Clayton Kershaw was another great example of this. He was just too good for the minor leagues. So when you see someone exhibiting A-plus stuff and throwing it for strikes, they just don't last in the minor leagues very long. Even a guy that young as Clayton Kershaw, they just sped him to the major leagues. And we'll see.
Felix Hernandez. Hernandez.
Another great example.
Felix Hernandez flew through the minor leagues. Why did he do that? Because you couldn't find a level in the minor leagues that challenged him.
Right. So that's not usually the case for hitters. But so the we're talking about the elite of the elite. So 65, 70, 75 grades, and the rare 80 grade. That just doesn't happen too often in the handbook. So there are a lot of 55s and 60s in the book.
Oh, by the way, I was going to interject. 175 in the book this year.
Yeah, I think
everyone knows who that is, Byron Buxton. But we were saying, because we got a question in the chat today, said, how can you say a number two is a 70, and then a 75 is a potential Hall of Famer? And it's like, well, because... like we talk about,
that's
with
the
this,
difference.
There are a lot more. There aren't many 70s in the book, but there are a lot more 70s every year in the book than there are 75s. This is, as you go down the level, we've had 180 in 3 years that we've done BA grades.
Yeah, not too many 75s. I mean, like Matt Moore, Mike Trout, Dylan Bundy, this year Byron Buxton. That might be it.
That might be it. Again, that's like we're talking like 5, 6, 7 in 3 years at 75. We've probably had 25, 30, 70s.
Yeah.
And, I mean, yeah. if you go down, like, think of this. This isn't a bell curve. When you get down to 40s, if you wanted to, we could write up 2,000 40s.
Right.
I mean, that's probably too much, but...
40 is a player with swingman or utility slash backup catcher upside or a same-side relief specialist. And I think that the key there is utility upside. A guy whose best-case scenario is a 200 at-bat versatile utility man. I mean, like, I don't even know. Like, who's an example of that? Like, because I used Robert Andino. Is that the... Like, that was probably the best case. I mean, but he was a semi-regular 1 year for the Orioles, although he was a horrible offense, a horrible regular.
I'm trying to think. I'm having to scan through the think of recent Astros. Like, I'm trying to think.
Johnny Paredes. You know.
Yeah, Johnny Paredes.
There was thought that there was more upside with him there. Like Brandon Barnes to me is a 40, the guy they just had in the big leagues. I mean, he played center field to an acceptable level for a team that was trying to lose games. No other way to put it. They were trying to lose. They succeeded in that try. And so he could make the occasional highlight outfield dive, and he was a well below average major league hitter. That's a 40. You know, he's a fifth outfielder on a championship team, if he's on a championship team at all.
This leads into kind of the discussion, like, because we had a lot of talking about figuring out how we, because we've, every year with the BA grades, we'd love to have them be completely consistent, but we try to improve them every year. We try to make sure that they're accurate every year. And we've had a lot of talk, much more about the 40s, between what's a 40, what's a 45, what's a 50.
Yep.
There's a lot more discussion we have every year on that than there is about what's a 75. The 75...
That's easier. The better the player is, the easier it is to write about.
I can describe, you just described, the 40 is a guy who, if you're starting a 40, you're saying something went horribly wrong.
Correct.
If you're starting a 45, there are 45s that start. There are multiple guys who are true 45s by what we're talking about here.
Yes.
Who start every year in the big leagues. The best way to describe it is a 45 who's starting is a guy who, there's a couple of things that almost always stand out about him. One, they're inexpensive. That's the guy you never are paying a lot of money.
Yeah, for a guy who's starting, yes.
Two, it's a guy who you don't want to be starting him most of the time, but okay, we have other problems.
He's basically a guy who doesn't profile. That's my shorthand. For a guy who does not profile is a 45 and who's a regular. For example, one of my all-time favorites, Ryan Garko, goes and starts on the 2007 Cleveland Indians. Had a decent year. It was the best year of his career. He did hit 21 home runs. That was in a very offensive era. 21 home runs in 2013 would have been probably solid average for a major league first baseman. At that time, I'm pretty sure it was below average. But on that team, he was the best they had at first base. He did bring a little bit of power, competitive at bats. He was a 45. That was his peak of his career. That's, to me, so he didn't have really enough power to really profile as a big league first baseman.
I'll give you another one of your guys.
Okay.
Doug Minkiewicz.
Doug Minkiewicz didn't, yeah. He was more of a, again, I think he might have been more of a 50 because he did hit for such high average. But he was consistent and he was a good defender. He did enough around the edges.
Right, I was going to say, he's on that borderline, but you also could argue that he's a guy, again,
yeah.
Really what it comes back to, I throw out another 45 who's now around now is Emilio Bonifacio. Emilio Bonifacio is a guy who, in an ideal situation, gets 300 at-bats for you, playing four different positions.
I mean, the main reason that Emilio Bonifacio is a 45 and not a 50 is that he's not good enough defensively at second base. If he played second base to an acceptable degree, he would be an everyday second baseman.
But he's not.
But he doesn't.
So because of that, he ends up being a 45.
Correct.
That's that gradation of 45. There are a lot of... You can think of it... I know there's a lot of things... Okay, if a guy's not a 50, then he's not a big league regular. That's really with this, what we've tried to refine it down to is no, there are a good number of 45s who are starting in the big leagues, and every team, every single team in baseball has 45s on their big league roster.
And a lot of them are very useful players.
So when you see 45 in here, that doesn't mean, again, because this is not OFP, but that does not mean that we're not saying this guy's probably not a big leaguer.
Right.
What we're saying is you have to have a realistic understanding of what this guy, how this guy is going to contribute. And in most cases, how he's going to contribute is in a more of a complementary role.
Exactly. That's perfectly
And a peak good. Of a 45, though, a 45 in his best year could end up being a guy who is an okay regular. But you probably are still looking to replace him.
Exactly. And like you said also, when he gets expensive, you're probably definitely looking to replace him. So just for example, again, the pitchers I put as 45s in this year's book are guys like a Matt Grier. That's almost like high for Matt Grier. Kevin Correa. Kevin Correa is not good, but he's also not that bad. In his best years, he eats up a lot of innings, and there's value in that. So his two best seasons over a full year, 198 innings for the Padres in 2009, 185 innings for the Twins in 2013. Both those years, like a 97 ERA plus, you know, modest strikeout numbers, you know, 6.5.
And for his career, it's an 89 ERA plus, which is really a fifth starter can be a 45.
Right.
It's on that cusp.
So in his best years, Kevin Correa is probably a fourth starter on a playoff team. You wouldn't think that, but I do think that's about a fourth starter on a playoff team is.
And if he is, then he's a 50.
Yeah, in his best years, he has that. But he's at that 45, 50.
Right. And that's
and
where
when you have the strikeout rate of 5.8 per nine,
that makes you a
45.
Because
if he had the same kind of ERA, if he had the same kind of production over the course of his career, but he was a little bit more of a strikeout guy, a little bit more of a hard thrower, we'd probably put him as a 50 in the book. But Kevin Correa, never really a big-time power arm.
Again, the difference, as we cite, as you quoted here, when you get the 50, Mike Leake's really more of a 50.
Yeah, so that's right.
Because Mike Leake is just that touch better on a year-in, year-out basis. And I know, obviously, they're at different points in their career.
Right.
But Mike Leake is a guy who, realistically, as long as Mike Leake's not... You're not looking to replace Mike Leake in any way, shape, or form unless he starts costing a lot of money.
Yeah. And if he,
for Evan Correa, you're probably looking like, okay, really, in an ideal situation, you're saying, especially he's at the expensive portion of his career, there's always a need for pitching, but you really would like to have someone better pitching ahead of him.
Right. I do think a big part of it, again, is with those pitchers, the 45 versus the 50 is, would you rather have this guy, do you want this guy to start game four of a playoff series for you or not? And if you don't think this guy's a playoff starter, then he's probably a 45. And if you think he does have a chance to start a playoff game for you, he's probably a 50.
And this brings it back, though, to the reliever thing, which is that most relievers are 40. I mean, most relievers are 45, even solid relievers. Because, again, what we've seen, we've been refining this year by year, but what you do see is that if you compared how teams value a 4/5 starter
right
to a setup man,
right,
they're really saying, well, we can find the setup man.
Scott Feldman is a fourth starter, I think, at best.
Yes.
He just got a $10 million contract per annually, 3 years, $30 million.
Mm-hmm.
Boone Logan is a setup man. Now, he's a left-on-left specialist. He's a unique kind of setup man. I was surprised by the contract he got from the Rockies, but what did he get, 3 years, $18
million? Right.
So those two guys...
And he's one of the few relievers who's even gotten 3 years this
right.
year.
Right. So it was so that just tells you the difference to me. Scott Feldman's not even like the best fourth starter, but there was a low supply and a high demand. He gets $10 million a year.
What would you consider Jason Hamill at this point?
Jason Hamill's a little bit better, I think, than Scott Feldman.
Well, contract-wise, he got a lot worse.
But he's hurt.
Yeah.
That's why.
Right.
I think there's injury lesson there. I mean, like Matt Grier, for me, as who I put as the 45, he's never been a closer. He has 6 career saves. He led the league in appearances twice with the Twins, so he was durable. His ERA plus, I think, is a little high at 120, a little bit higher than you might think because there's a couple of
But relievers, a 120 for a reliever is average
right.
at best.
Right, and then 6 strikeouts per 9, 3 walks. I mean, he's just Johnny Average middle reliever to me, and he's been durable. He's done it for a decade. Kent State represent, you know, good for Matt Grier, part of the Kent State pitching family, but to me, he encapsulates really what a 45 is as far as a relief pitcher. So I liked him as a because if you have a minor league prospect, if you're an organization, you have a prospect that has a durable, reliable middle relief career like Matt Grier, there is value in that. And a guy who's a 45, especially if Matt Grier in your minor league system has done it in AA and AAA, maybe for 15, 20 outings of the big leagues in September. I wouldn't be embarrassed to have that guy in my top 10 prospects. I'd rather have 10 guys better than him.
Mm-hmm.
But if you tell me a guy who's going to be a consistent middle reliever for a decade, like Matt Grier basically has been, then there's value in that. And that, as a prospect, that does have some value. But I think that, like you said, teams do not see that as valuable. And our this is a way that our rankings have started to reflect that.
I just picked a team at random. Looking at the Braves list, Sean Gilmartin, number 10 on their list. You know, we'll give away a couple
prior to the trade, obviously.
Prior to the trade, but, you know, because he's obviously been traded to the, you know, Twins at this point. But he was, you know, prior to the trade, 45 media. He's number 10. Realistically, at this point with Sean Gilmartin, if you get anything better than a number 5 starter out of him,
I mean, his peak to me is going to be like a Scott Diamond 2012 year, which is why it's perfect that the Twins went and got him. I mean,
right,
the Twins have made this emphasis on going to get more power arms, and
they went and got
Sean Gilmartin. Kind of made me chuckle. Hey, I love you, but, Twins, but that was such a perfect Twins acquisition. It made me laugh.
But to put it in comparison, though, Shea Simmons, number 16 in the Braves system, who could probably on his knees maybe throw harder than Sean Gilmartin.
It would be close that way.
You know, he touched 100. You know, he's got electric stuff.
He looks like he's from his knees up the time. What is he, 5'9"?
Yeah, he is. He is a short.
I'm sure Shea Simmons has never heard that joke ever.
But he's a 45 medium.
Yeah.
This is, again, what we're trying to do here is the point of the BA grades is compared. For one thing, what you can tell by that is that, again, Gilmartin's been traded since then, but there's not a whole lot of difference, for one thing, we're saying, between number 10 and 16 on this list. If you say, how dare you have him 10, I would put him 16, and I would put Simmons at 10, we're saying, that's debatable.
Exactly.
I mean, we're saying because they've got the same grade.
That's the other thing I like about the grades is that they do present the fact that this is not cut and dry. This is baseball.
This is all about probabilities.
That's right.
We've both been doing this long enough to know. Again, I'll give Byron Buxton as an example. Byron Buxton right now is, to me, as when you talk about probabilities, he's as surefire the probability that he'll be a productive big leaguer as anyone I can think of in the minors. Because you see all the things that he presently does, not projection.
Right.
Presently, he should be a above average defensive center fielder with a plus arm. He doesn't have to develop that. It's there.
There's no projection on 3 of his tools.
He's got to run.
Yeah, the arm, the speed, the defense. There's no projection there.
So when it comes to the bat, that was one of the things that was fun about doing this list of the ranking them of all time. You may think that you've got it nailed. I can tell you, having from talking to scouts who do this, you know, every day also, and there are players that you could ask, well, why did that guy bust? And sometimes the answer is, you know, I don't know.
Yep.
Jeremy Hermida, who was a cover boy for us, Jeremy Hermida in the minors, going on the way up, controlled the strike zone.
Yeah, he checked every box.
Hit for average, showed developing power, and the power. And the thing about it is the power arrived. He had a year as a 23-year-old in the big leagues where the power was there. You know, it all was there. He slugged, I mean, his age 23 season in the big leagues was one that you would say, wow, this guy's going to be a star. And as a 27-year-old, he couldn't hold a big league job.
It's amazing to me how Jeremy Hermida's career went. You know, you kind of half expect to find, to read, like, that there was some off-the-field problem that we don't know about.
Yeah, that's what I always come back to. We're dealing with humans.
Right.
You know, it's not robotic. I mean, so the reality of it is that you do never know, not just injuries, but again, and I've asked people, like, what happened there? And I've never gotten a good answer on that.
I never have gotten a good answer on Hermida either.
Delmon Young is one, you know, he also ranked poorly on our...
Delmon, what happened to you?
But Delmon
Young, turn around.
It's easy to answer.
Yes, Delmon's now working on the rotating Enterprise restaurant right now.
That's a joke
JJ and I have made too many times in the last 12 years, 11 years, whatever it is, but... Yes, it's a Bill Shatner SNL joke, very long ago.
But Delmon is not nearly as athletic as he was coming up. And that made when you go from being...
Also a bad person.
Yes. But when you go from being an impact defender, you know, a guy who had a chance to be a very, like, a plus in right field...
Yeah, he was a profile right fielder before, being, early career, and then he became a profile DH.
To being a guy who you can't feel comfortable putting in left...
Yeah, he became a profile DH who doesn't hit enough. I mean, that's really a...
You know, and also...
It's a brutal profile.
And again, with him, there are guys who they have trouble with, you know, their plate discipline shows signs it needs to improve, and it does... There's other guys that never does. Delmon Young is an example of a guy that never does. But again, it was useful. There's a story up today, you know, wrote about ranking our BA cover subjects, you know, of our prospect handbooks. And one of the things that stood out was I liked the fact that Delmon Young and Jeremy Hermida were there right together. The thing that jumps out is that you may think, okay, well, it's, you know, well, you can look at it. It's the strike. He didn't walk and he struck out a lot.
Right.
And then you have Jeremy Hermida right by him and you say, he didn't strike out a whole lot and he walked a lot.
Right.
It's not as simple as that.
And when he got to the big leagues, he wasn't like overly passive. It was like 2-1 strikeout to walk his first full year, and he had an 870 OPS that year. And there were no giant red flags, but his walk rate stagnated. His strikeout rate kept going up. His contact rate went down. It's amazing.
What's fascinating is that when he went back to the minors, you know, when he basically had effectively failed, and was back
in Major League 3?
Yeah, 3. I think it's 3. But, you know, when he had failed and he was back in the minors, all of a sudden then he was what would look like a hacker who struck out a whole lot more than he walked.
Yeah, last year in Columbus, he still, I think he signed in Korea or Japan this offseason. I know he signed overseas, but I mean, 247, 365, 416, still just 29 years old. I mean, but just amazing. It's amazing. His 2005 year in Carolina, the year before we put him on the cover, I mean, 975 OPS for the Mudcats. 457 on base, and he was hitting for power. He was athletic.
How many strikeouts to walk that day?
111 walks and 89 strikeouts.
Like, there's,
it's
again,
really hard to believe.
There's nothing about that would say, you know, and again, this is where scouting comes in, but yeah, I haven't talked to a guy who said, yeah, I was never a Hermida believer.
Yeah.
It's not one of those guys. I mean, again, pitching, it's always easier to kind of write because guys get hurt, their velocity, they lose confidence, there's all these kind of things. It's really weird when you see a hitter have it and then just lose it.
Somewhere out there, there's a tape of George Brett talking about how much he likes Jeremy Hermida, in between talking about whether he's fouled himself in the hotel lobby. Because that was the year where the was a 2002 draft where the Royals had what I think the 9th pick, and they wound up taking Zach Greinke, also a Clemson signee, as was Jeremy Hermida. But like, there was a big stir that year with Jeremy Hermida. Really, we had him, I think, as a supplemental draft pick coming into the year, and he got off to this great start, and everybody went crazy when George Brett dropped in to go see him and then told the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, that's the best young hitter I've seen in years. I mean, like, that's a pretty good stamp of approval. Mm-hmm. So that list was fun, JJ, because a lot of these other guys would have gotten pretty lofty grades. And you mentioned Josh Beckett.
I think he'd have been 75.
I think he would have been probably a 75. Bryce Harper got an 80. He was in the grade era.
Joe Mauer. I think he'd have been an 80.
You know, Joe Mauer might have been the first year, but I bet you we would have adjusted him down after. Because remember, he was in the handbook a second time after he had 109 big league at-bats and then hurt his knee in the major leagues. Right. I bet you we would have dinged him on that.
We would have dinged him on that. The risk would have gone up. And maybe because of more questions of, okay, he's going to be able to stay at catcher long term. But before the injury that year, I think he'd have been an 80.
But he was our minor league player of the year. And, you know, even then, I do wonder, because he had 9 home runs that year. So
maybe not.
I wonder if he would have gotten the 80. But we definitely thought he was kind of the perfect prospect. And we were right. I mean, the guy won 3 batting champions. My son is obsessed with Ernie Lombardi because of our Baseball America National Hall of Fame almanac.
I am obsessed. Your son and I share that obsession.
He does, because if you mention Ernie Lombardi, I've shown him the picture. He goes, that's the guy who can hold 7 balls at one time.
Please tell me you have given him you made sure that he reads the Bill James Baseball Historical Abstract, like 7 pages on Ernie Lombardi.
Not yet, but that will happen. Yes, that will happen. But he loves the page in the book. But so every time I'm always like, well, imagine Ernie Lombardi only with better defense and could move
and could get to first base in less than 10 seconds.
Exactly. And I said, then you have Joe. I said, well, that's Joe Mauer. You're getting to see almost a better version of Ernie Lombardi.
Not almost.
With smaller hands.
Yes. But and a better smaller version nose. Of Ernie Lombardi.
Smaller nose, smaller hands.
I do love the point in the Bill James historical abstract. He's talking about, like, if the ball got by Lombardi, it wasn't a question of whether you were going to get to the next base. It was a question of, will he make it all the way around?
Yeah, and Ernie Lombardi was in the wrong time, because back then, no one thought about when they built the ballpark, I don't care how close or how far the fans are from the action. Fans, who gives a damn about fans? Those cranks. I mean, that's basically what it was like. So, yeah, he loves Lombardi.
So
I think we would have given him a 70.
We have skipped over here. So that's the 45 and 50.
Yeah, the meat of the book is the 45, 50, and the 55, 60. The 55, 60, I don't think we redefined that this year. first division regulars and number three starters and elite closers. Alvis Andrews, to me, is a 55. If you don't think he's a first division starter at shortstop, you're kidding yourself. I mean, he is. Mm-hmm. That just tells you a little bit more about shortstop offense and our expectations of it. But there are a lot of Alvis Andrews haters out there. I don't love him, but what he is a first division shortstop. Mm-hmm. Jay Bruce, Craig Kimbrell, Justin Masterson. All these guys are guys who have a hickey, except for Kimbrell, where his hickey is that he's a closer.
His hickey is that he's a closer, so you say. All the rest I mean, he's the elitist of elite closers. I mean, again, now that Mariano Rivera is.
Right.
If you're gonna give a 60 to a closer, it's Mariano Rivera.
He's the elite closer.
Mariano Rivera is a 65 or 70.
I was about to say he's a 70.
Yeah.
He breaks the scale. And I mean, like, Aroldis Chapman, we'd probably give Aroldis Chapman a 60 as well. I mean, I'm sure his OFP is higher, but that's not what the BA grade is. But, you know, we could have put Aroldis Chapman there. To me, Craig Kimbrell has been more dominant than Chapman. That's why I used him as the example.
He said Kimbrell's had the last 2 years like that. Chapman had a year, one a year like that.
And they're so rare to have consistent closers. And the other thing is that Chapman, they're both extremely rare birds. I mean, that's the thing. A closer, it's just very hard to project.
But when you say elite closers, the thing that comes back to those is how many elite closers are in the game right now? We're talking about number one starters. It's much the same thing.
I think it's actually more rare. We named two of the three. To me, Joe Nathan's the only other one. Who else is like a truly, would you call Jonathan Papelbon an elite closer?
Not at this point.
At one point, maybe
he was, but maybe.
I mean, a guy, and to me, as someone who has to hold that closer job for 2, 3, 4 years. That just doesn't happen very often anymore.
Hold it and...
Thrive in it.
Like, there's holding it. Like, you can say Greg Holland had an elite closer year last year.
Anybody can just take the safe chance. Right. The holding the safe chance is the key.
And again, it's what makes Mariano Rivera so truly unique is you had a guy who did it for almost 20 years, year in, year out.
And Sergio Romo is now getting to that. It's been 2 years now that he's been the Giants closer. And he did it in the crucible of the postseason. We would never have given Sergio Romo a 60. I tell you that.
No.
And I will never be ashamed of missing on a Sergio Romo. I mean, like, we ranked
him. I love talking to a scout who saw him as an amateur. Said he's the same guy as an amateur as he is now. This is what makes this all so fascinating.
It's fun.
Is because if you said, okay, and I asked him the question, I said, so explain to me what it is about this undersized pitcher who has good, but not like stuff that, you know, jumps out where you say this is, he said, I mean, it's feel for pitching, it's makeup, it's all these things that, for the lack of a better word, are unquantifiable in many ways.
Right.
You scout them, you project on them, but you never can be certain.
I mean, Sergio Romo is 30 years old. He's listed at 5'10". He has a career 10 strikeouts per nine, 1.8 walks. Well, he has all the things that you that profile you as a great major league relief pitcher. He probably would have been a 45 at best. I don't think we ever would have projected him as more than a middle reliever.
Do remember, it's worth kind of remembering with this. Also talking to scouts, like, so, I mean, did he stand out at that point? 28th round pick. He said no, he was...
28th or 32nd. I always thought he was a 32nd round pick.
Says 28th and B. At least we're looking on the BREF page. But,
yeah, okay.
But 28th round pick.
That was, of course, a year where the Giants famously did not pick until the fourth round. They still got three future big leaguers, him being the best one.
But 28th round pick, and talking to this scout who, again, saw him when he was still, you know, an amateur, he went undrafted 1 year and really was about to get out of the game.
But I can say, yeah, pack it up and pack it in.
And pack it and say, okay, well, I'm done with this. And it's like, no. You know, a couple of scouts helped him kind of get into a JUCO, and that really made the difference as he went on to become a World Series champion closer.
Yeah, one of the best Division II draft picks in the big leagues
now. And he did rank number 10 in the.
What I like better is that the year before he was number 28. He was in our list the year before at number 28 before he ever made it to the major league. So, yeah, the Giants knew they had something. I don't even think they knew what they had. And again, we don't know. We're making, I wouldn't even say educated guesses, but we do have a lot of information on these players. But the rankings, I think the grades do, and profiling these guys. So I think the grades bring some order out of the chaos. It's hard to keep them very consistent over 900 guys.
We work really hard at it. And
that was the focus of the last 3 days of the book. Clint Longenecker deserves a lot of credit for marshaling those forces of basically me, Clint, and Matt Eddy going over like all 900 grades, and we're still not satisfied with all 900 of them, but the book has to get done, and here it is March, you know, February 1st, and we're shipping the book February 3rd, so I'm glad that we're finally shipping the book. It feels like it takes a long time, but we finished the book at the end of December, so 1 month between finishing the book, printing it, proofing it, getting it out, shipping it.
The best way I can put it is I know that people, we see it, people love rankings.
Yes.
Whatever we rank, people love. It's just, you know that. That being said, if you ask me what's more valuable in this book, if you had to take one or the other out, if we ranked them in each team in alphabetical order with the BA grades, or we took the BA grades out and had them rankings, I think in the grand scheme, because I also think we had a question in the chat asking, this is my first prospect handbook I'm getting. What should I expect? What will I be surprised by? The key thing about this is that I hope, and when you get this book, it's something you can enjoy now to get ready for the season.
Right.
It's something you can use continually through the season. If you go to a minor league game,
right,
there's a whole lot of value in this, because that's why we go 900 deep, is that you're going to have players in that game who are in this book. And I hope that it's going to add value to going to that game, because you're going to be able to read a report on, and then the players aren't static. Read the report and go, okay, is he showing something different than this?
Right.
Is he throwing harder? Is he throwing softer? Is he added a pitch that he didn't have at that point?
I like the idea. I love it when scouts tell me that, and I have a lot of pro scouts who get the book. I like to say, I don't like to read what you guys write about him before. I like to read it after. So I'll go see a guy. I don't want to go in with a preconceived notion.
Well, that makes sense.
But they'll go in, they'll see the guy. And I have a couple of pro guys who are two of my better sources in terms of they like to give – they've been very useful over the years at giving me feedback on where we're on it and where we're not. And I really value that feedback significantly.
We all do. Absolutely.
I mean, yeah, absolutely. And so I like it. I love to hear – one of them this year said, man, every time I went to go see this guy – and I'd write down what he was. I went back in my hotel room and pulled out your handbook, and that's what he was. So I almost like for the reader to go, you know, enjoy the game. Be a fan of the game.
Right.
I mean, everybody, there are a lot of fans and a lot of our listeners who want to go out there and be scouts on their own, and more power to them. It's the 21st century. There's a lot of that going on. But to me, the book is meant to make you enjoy being a baseball fan more. Well, so if I'm a Twins fan, and I go to a Twins a minor league game, and I see Stuart Turner, and I'm like, oh, wow. If I go see him and he's in the game, and I notice that game Stuart Turner threw out a guy trying to steal, or there weren't any pass balls, or wow, there were a couple of nice blocks in that, then I go read that Stuart Turner was the most polished college catcher in the draft class, and he's a glove over bat catcher. You know, I want it to match up. And if they don't, please let us know. But that's how I think the book is intended to be used.
And the other thing about it is that, okay, when we get to the midseason, there's trades.
Yes.
When prospects are involved, not all of them, but a whole lot of them are going to be in this book. That's why we go 900 deep. So
absolutely,
it has value at that point. But also, I know I personally love pulling out, you know, I almost too much, love pulling out, let's pull out the 2005 book and flip through it. Okay.
Right.
Where were we right? Where were we wrong? Huh. How was that guy then thought of compared to how he's thought of now?
Right.
And also, not only that, but I learn every time I do that from the standpoint of, like, again, writing up Jeremy Hermanis, like, it was just a good reminder. Guy who had more walks than strikeouts in AA while hitting for power. Oh, yeah, that's not an absolute slam dunk that this guy's going to be.
Or Brandon Wood. I mean, Brandon Wood's one of the all-time examples. A guy in 2005 who had more than 100 extra base hits on a year. I mean, it was a historic year.
And it goes a step further than that. Like, I always thought with Brandon Wood, my takeaway from that was, Cal League, be afraid. And I really did. I took from that, like, Cal League, be afraid. And then I took from that when I was just recently doing something. I was like, you know, did we hang on to him as a prospect too long? Did
right.
we, after that, not see our, in hindsight, should we have seen signs that, you know, he's not what we think he is? And then I looked at his couple years after that. And I know it was PCL. I mean, there was qualifiers to it. But that being said, I look back at him, it's like, wow, that was a lot louder than I remember, you know.
Yeah, he never stopped hitting.
He
not
hit,
in the minor leagues.
In the minor leagues, he hit, to lack of a better, everywhere.
Yeah.
He did. I mean, it wasn't something where you say, okay, well, really, we should have understood, looking back at it, that it really was, he was a Cal League creation. And there was a part of me that thought that was the case. He had an outstanding year in the Cal League, but I thought, okay, after that. And then you look at what he did, and it's like, after that.
It was a historic year. It wasn't just a good Cal League year. That's the thing. It was historic even for the
And then he goes to Arkansas, which is a very difficult place to hit, 276, 355, 552. He goes to Salt Lake. First year Salt Lake was, you could see some hiccup, 272, 338, 497. But again, as a middle infielder.
Yeah.
Then he goes back to Salt Lake and goes 296, 375, 595. And he goes back to Salt Lake and goes 293, 353, 557. There was, again, I learned from that, going back and reading those reports, it's like, okay, what little signs were there? And you find things from that. But,
yeah.
And by the way, also a reminder, if you are a Baseball America subscriber, you could go to the Player Finder, type in Brandon Wood, and you can read all those old reports because we've got them up there.
Yeah, I mean, that's for subscribers. His career stats, obviously,
are for free, but the scouting reports you can read that we said what we said back then, every one of those years is, you know, you can see it there.
So. I knew I didn't remember. I don't even remember my own Baseball America password. I never remember my login password to baseballamerica.com.
But now we need to get on to the second part of it, which is risk.
And the risk, you know, what defines a risk factor? And we've talked about adding gradations to our risk factors at the back end. We've talked about getting rid of safe because we have, I think, a different definition. What's safe to me is different for some other people in the office. We put a safe on Brandon Compton this year because his ceiling is so low, and I feel like he achieved his ceiling last year. In my opinion, his ceiling is fifth starter, and that's what he did. Mm-hmm. Effectively for the Pittsburgh Pirates last year.
Your viewpoint is safe can only happen to a guy who's already demonstrated at the big league level.
Yes.
Right.
That's,
And I don't even necessarily disagree with it, but we've talked about maybe changing that to something like very low.
Because baseball is not a safe endeavor.
Right. But, again, and that's true. I mean, again.
It says in the book, has shown realistic ceiling in big leagues.
But we've talked about maybe changing that because.
Which I don't agree with.
Right, I know. My thought is that change it to very low where you can rope in, where it can be some, by the nature of how it is right now, if you're a position player and you are safe, you no longer qualify for the book.
Whereas, I don't think that's true. I think there are going to be position players who are going to get that safe.
It's very hard though, because a position player doing something, having a good September doesn't necessarily even then, you have to look at it. I mean, September's different baseball. Whereas a reliever can come up and do it for 2 months and really demonstrate it.
The only reason Xander Bogaerts got a low and not a safe is because of the question of which position he's going to play.
Right.
That's it. That's the only question. So he came within a scintilla of safe.
Mike Trout was a safe.
I think he was. I think he was a safe in one spot and a low in another.
And it was supposed to be safe.
Right.
But that one's a very rare category.
It is rare. And I think it should be rare.
Yeah, it should be rare.
So that's why I don't have a problem with it being as rare as it is. It had been pointed out that it's so rare, maybe we should get rid of it. So it's under discussion. Low, likely to reach realistic ceiling, certain big league career barring injury. That's a pretty strong designation in and of itself. I'd almost rather have a low than a safe. Because who's really reached their realistic ceiling in the major leagues and is still prospect eligible?
Relievers.
Fringy guys, exactly. Relievers.
That's what.
The exception was Matt Moore, who had only come up in September. They had the loophole to get him in the playoffs, and then he was an ace in the playoffs. So he's such an exception. It does take the planets aligning for an exceptional talent to get a safe. That's why I actually think it's more like a guy like a couple of years ago, Lance Lynn, who had pitched 30-some innings in the big leagues, had done a little starting, a little relieving.
And also got the extra playoff time, which always helps.
Right.
So you get to see an extra 18 innings.
Exactly. Or Brandon Workman in this book. Still eligible for the book by the way we keep him. And he had not pitched enough. He was an eighth inning. He pitched the eighth inning in the clinching game of the World Series. That, if that's his ceiling...
He has shown us
he can do that. So how is he not safe? Mm-hmm. He's safe to me. I just made my case. The defense rests, Your Honor. Most guys in this book are high. And the next most are extreme. And that's the change.
And really what we've... Because, again, what it comes down to, we're not saying this is 10%. You know, you got a 90% chance, a 75% chance, a 50, a 25, and a 10. That's not what we're not breaking it down like that.
Right.
But in some way, you can say, like, if you're an A-ball, there are so many different ways, so many different hurdles that can get in your way.
Yep.
Because, for one, you may find at a higher level, there's a whole lot of guys who dominate A-ball, and then they get to double-A, and all of a sudden, their weaknesses are exposed. You can get hurt.
Yeah.
You can have basically lose it. I mean, guys...
What grade would we have given Brandon Wood in 2005? After the 2005 season, when he has...
Medium?
51 doubles. That's what I'm saying. He should have been high.
Right. But we would probably give him a medium, because his strikeout rate was
And he was a middle of the diamond player. Yeah. He was a shortstop.
But there was concern, like if you said, why would he have been medium? He probably would not have gotten high the year he had, but he would have been medium because he had a lot of strikeouts.
Right.
And there were questions at the time, like, okay, he's shown enough power to stay at that third base shouldn't be a problem.
Right.
But he may not stay at shortstop.
Correct. So, I mean, like, but he would have gotten a pretty high grade, and he probably would have been like a 70 medium in A ball. And I just think he's a great example of what can trip you up. On the way to A-ball, I mean, from A-ball to the big leagues. And so, really, it's very rare, I think, that someone who's an A-ball is going to get less risk than high.
Right, and that's what, again, we see a guy like Byron Buxton who did get less risk than high.
Yeah.
What it comes back to, though, is that with Byron Buxton, the other thing you see so rarely in A-ball is a guy who truly is exhibiting. It's not just about he walked a lot, he didn't strike out much. How's he doing that, too?
His polish.
And you're seeing it with Buxton. You see, like, wow, his pitch recognition is excellent. His understanding of the strike zone is excellent.
I'll go back to what the Giants said about Fred Lewis. They said he accidentally walked a lot in low A. They were right. That wasn't the right word. But he did, basically, he did not have a polished approach to the plate. He didn't recognize pitches. And if he didn't recognize it, he took it in an A-ball. More often than not, it was out of the strike zone.
You're going to succeed doing that. Like, That's one of those things that it's funny, but again, if you're an A-ball, if you're a college guy in A-ball with a slider speed bat, but good pitch recognition, you can put up a stat line that makes it look like you are really impressive. Because for one, you are going to see bad breaking balls.
Right, right.
You are going to see breaking balls that you can destroy. And while you will see velocity, if you have an understanding of the strike zone, you will a lot of times be able to look at it like, no, it's out of the zone.
Fred Lewis ranked in our Giants top 10 5 years in a row.
By the way, Miguel Sano, this is his fifth handbook.
Yeah, I mean, I think we ran him up to number 4 the first year he signed.
Yeah.
With the Twins. It was not a good Twins farm system when he signed, JJ.
But
it's
looks good at having him number 4 on that list. But no.
It wasn't a good system.
But medium... Medium, still some work to do to turn tools into major league caliber skills. There are a whole lot of really good prospects who are medium, because medium effectively means you are right on track.
You're closing the gap between potential and production.
We just still need to, but you've got to demonstrate that you can do it at higher levels,
right.
Or you have, really it's one of the two things. Either, if you're an A-ball, it's almost like, again, unless you are truly exceptional, you're doing everything right in A-ball.
I mean, a good example is Tommy La Stella. Tommy La Stella is a medium because he's an extreme example of a prospect. He doesn't profile, so he's a 45. But he's a medium because if he stays healthy, we're pretty confident that guy's going to hit.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're not the only ones. I think a lot of scouts are pretty confident that Tommy La Stella is going to hit. Do I think he's going to be an impact player? I don't know. Like I said, he doesn't really profile because usually you want your middle infielders to be a little bit more athletic than Tommy La Stella is.
And it always comes back to the question, like when you say, you know, still some work to do to turn tools into major league caliber skills, the skill that we do not know if he'll have is, can he play second base every
right.
day?
Right. And that's really, the other reason that he's risky is his injury history. It's pretty lengthy. I don't believe Tommy La Stella's ever played 100 games in a season. So I know Dan Uglow was terrible last year. I get it. That Braves fans would love to see Tommy La Stella sooner than later, but his career get high in games played is probably this year. I don't know how many he played in the fall league, but he was in the fall league and he played 88 games in the regular season. So asking him to play 162 games in the major leagues, he hasn't shown he could play 100 in the minor leagues yet. So that adds some risk. Because usually a bat that polished with that kind of performance at double A is not a medium. It's probably going to be a low when you hit like that, and he has a long track record of hitting.
But the defense also.
The defense and the injury risk. And that's,
again, especially because really, and there's a number of these guys in here, when you talk about don't fit the profile, second baseman who can hit, and there's questions about whether they can play second,
that's a tough profile.
Frightening one.
Because that's a tough one.
It always comes back to, and if that doesn't work, then what are you going to do?
Exactly. It's not, especially if they're at second base because they don't have great arm strength. Like Jeff Kent, Jeff Kent played some third base early career. I always felt like I haven't asked a scout like why didn't he play more third base? Why did he end up at second base where he was more of a liability, more exposed? I guess that he was worse at third base than he was at second.
Well, I think also though, it's like again, I think there are a lot of teams who feel like that second base is a less defensively demanding position. And
sure.
I mean, again, second base, I've had second baseman tell me. Second base, you can just knock it down. If you got an arm, you knock it down. You can.
Hey, Ricky Weeks corollary.
Right. And so with that being the case, you put a guy. But if you can't play second base defensively, you're not going to be a utility infielder because.
Right.
Even if you can play second base occasionally as a utility infielder, you can't play short, you can't play third.
The only place you can go is to first base.
Or left field.
And that's not where you want to go. So, especially if you're Tommy La Stella and you're 5'9". So, got to meet him in the fall league, rooting for Tommy La Stella. There's some real question marks there.
So really, again, though, what we're trying to do, an extreme, we had a couple, there are a couple of different ways you get an extreme. And we'll try to, you know, kind of wrap this up. But a couple ways you get an extreme. One is, if you have a significant injury history, not you had an injury.
Right.
But, okay, well, actually, I take that back. If you have a shoulder injury and, like, you're a pitcher and you have not come back from that shoulder injury,
yes,
you're extreme because the track record on that is such that we have to see, are you going to be, you know, the chance of you reaching your ceiling is questionable at that point.
Right.
If you have concussions, we decided this year, we've seen with concussions, there's a whole lot of guys who have never made it back
right
from concussions.
Concussions, I just made a command decision, automatic extreme. If the write-up says you had a concussion this year, whether you're Tommy Joseph or whoever else, you got an extreme. And
because you got to demonstrate that you are fully, that is behind you.
We just have seen, it's been 9 years since Corey Koski. We've seen the issues with Justin Morneau. I'm sure there are other ones, but those are the two that jump in my head. Mm-hmm. Ryan Friel. How about the late Ryan Friel, who had concussions and it looked like had CTE after
not
his...
Not looked like, was diagnosed.
Yeah, it was diagnosed after... autopsy showed CTE in his brain. I mean, if you have concussion issues, you got an extreme grade.
And then, obviously, also, if you were a July 2 guy who signed this year, you're going to get a... if you haven't made it to the States...
Right.
You know, from if you signed as a 16, 17-year-old and have yet to make it to the U.S., you're going to get an extreme because the reality is that every level up the ladder gets you a little closer.
Right.
Every level up the ladder is also it's an opportunity, and it's also a chance for the opponent
right.
to prove that you aren't able to handle this level.
Right.
And if you have 6 or 7 of those levels to go, the risk is much higher than if you have 2.
Like you said, it just goes back to probability. I mean, it just I don't know if there are any July 2nd guys who didn't get an extreme in the whole book. Any 16-year-olds. I mean, it says...
I'm flipping to the Cubs because I would think that, like, Eloy, if there was going to be someone, it would be someone like...
Nah, he still got an extreme, I believe.
Yeah, 55 extremes.
Yep. But, like, teenagers in rookie ball or players with significant injury histories, what we should have added...
This guy, you know, is an extreme.
Even though he's been in the major leagues. What we should have thrown in there in the extreme is if you have...
A
strikeout rate or something in the statistical profile that makes you very risky. Striking out a lot more than you walk.
If you played at Hickory for the Rangers this year, you're extreme.
Pretty much. Is there anybody on that?
Jorge Alfaro, I think, did not get it. I think he just got a high.
He's just a high? Yeah, he's a high.
He's a high. But
Nick Williams, extreme. Joey Gallo, extreme. Yeah, most of those guys are going to get... Ronald Guzman, only a high.
He's a little bit more...
Probably best field for hit. On that team, he only got a high.
Lewis Brinson, extreme. Like, if you play, I mean, again, but
Lewis Brinson almost defines extreme.
Yeah. You actually, again, if there was another grade beyond Lewis Brinson, he of the 72 different batting stances last year would.
Joe LeClerc got a high. That surprises me.
But again, if you have a high strikeout rate as a hitter, like an obscenely high one, or as a pitcher, if you don't strike anyone out,
right,
and you have great statistical success, if you're a guy, Or if you walk a ton. The one to me was, who was the reliever for the Indians this year?
In the major leagues or the minor leagues?
No, in the handbook. There's a reliever for the Indians who's had some, Trey Haley. Trey Haley, he walked 39 in 44 innings this past year. That's we gave him a high. I was arguing for an extreme on that one.
I think I remember that. I think a 45 extreme would have not put him in the book.
Yes, yeah, so it was too late in the process, so we went, okay, I'll stay off a high. Next year, I'll get him to be extreme.
But it is an inexact process and an inexact science. That said, I like our process. I like that we have some consensus. I like there's also room for individual ranking. But I do think that the grades and the risk factor do take a little bit of the individuality out of the rankings. It's very hard to go out and
justify
rank.
It now.
You really have to justify it a lot more than you ever had to. And we know it's not 100% consistent, but we feel like it's probably, if it was 85 the first year, it's probably 93, 94, 95 this year, and we're just working to make the book better every year.
The great thing about it is a lot of these same guys, we're the same guys doing it every year, so now I see a guy and I can often think, 50 high.
That. Exactly. You've seen that before, so... we do appreciate the download. Hope you have purchased the book. If you have not, once again, 800-845-2726 to order it. We're on the Eastern time zone, if you didn't already know that. So basically 9 to 5 Eastern to order that, or anytime at baseballamerica.com/store. So for JJ Cooper at JJCoop36, I'm John Manuel at John Manuel BA. We'll see you in the next Baseball America podcast. So long, everybody.